We're going to take a look at some of the headlines that relate to events going on in Europe by way of hitting the ground running and moving right back into the present. From the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, October 6th of 1992, article by Nomi Morris of the Chronicle Foreign Service Dateline of Berlin, headlined, 2 years after unification, an ugly mood prevails, talking about Germany. I think that's something of an understatement under the circumstances. From the New York Times of Monday, September 28th of 1992, article by Stephen Kinzer, dateline Chemnitz, Germany, headlined, Youths Adrift in a New Germany, Turn to Neo-Nazis. Something which has a chillingly familiar ring and perhaps goes to illustrate what William Faulkner said, the past is never dead and buried, it isn't even past. From the New York Times of Wednesday, September 16th of 1992, another article by Stephen Kinzer, dateline Bonn, September 15th, headlined, Light Sentences Against Germans Who Killed Foreigner, Stir Debate. Recall that in a miscellaneous archive show entitled The New Germany and the Old Nazis, we took a look at the fact that the German official and charged with containing rightist, the violence of extreme right-wing organizations is Deputy Interior Minister Eduard Lindner, who himself is a member of the Sudetendeutsche Landsmannschaft, which is an organization that advocates the return of the Sudetenland to Germany. So light sentences in light of the perpetuation of much of the Third Reich's judicial system and the presence of Mr. Lindner in that position, well, that should not come as too much of a surprise. Nor should this from the San Francisco Examiner of Tuesday, September 1st of 1992. Article by Kevin Costello, C-O-S-T-E-L-L-O-E of the AP. Dateline Berlin headline, Violence in Germany was plotted. Subheaded, Police warn that attacks could spread. Again, perhaps not too much of a surprise. And from the San Francisco Examiner, or from the San Jose Mercury News Evening Edition, this from Friday, August 28th of 1992, about the neo-Nazi anti-foreigner rioting in Germany. This is from the Mercury News Wire Services Dateline Berlin headline, Worst is yet to come in Germany's anti-foreigner rioting. Interestingly, there's a subhead here, a quote from a German observer, a citizen observing the rioting, quote, Somebody should give those boys a bouquet for accomplishing what the politicians wouldn't. Well, that is perhaps that was a premature statement because now the politicians are beginning to do exactly what the neo-Nazis wanted. Namely, they're beginning to expel foreigners. From the LA Times of Friday, September 18th of 1992. We find an article by Tamara Jones of the L.A. Times staff, Dateline Berlin headline, Bond to expel thousands of Romanians and gypsies, subheaded repatriation. Bucharest will take back its citizens who don't qualify for asylum under German law. Again, a chillingly familiar ring to headlines like that. And on the front page of that very same edition of the L.A. Times, we find the following story by Joel Havemann, H-A-V-E-M-A-N-N, of the L.A. Times, Dateline Brussels, and headlined, Europe currency crisis deepens, lira plummets. Finance, Germany refuses to cut interest rates. The franc faces pressure, but British pound grows stronger. And the preeminence of the Deutsche Mark is one of the central factors in the chaos that is embracing European currency fluctuations at the moment. From the New York Times of Tuesday, September 15th of 1992. And again, by way of evaluating how the U.S. lost the Second World War, just take a look at how the effect of the very powerful Deutsche Mark on the world economy. This is an article by Richard W. Stevenson of the New York Times, Dateline London, September 14th of 1992, headlined, German rates cut, setting off surge in world markets. Subheaded, first drop in 5 years, and again, faced with French treaty vote, bond responds to pressure to help Europe recover. So a very slight cut in German interest rates has caused the world's capital markets to soar. From the L.A. Times of Tuesday, September 22nd of 1992, article by Tom Petruno of the L.A. Times, headline, French vote fails to halt surging German mark, subheaded, Markets, analysts say slim vote majority wasn't enough to calm nerves of traders, Dow drops 6.2%. 2-2. By way of evaluating our own economic future, a very chilling headline from the L.A. Times of Friday, October 6th of 1992. This is entitled, this is by James Bates of the L.A. Times, Citicorp's president quits unexpectedly. American banking experts, many of them anyway, are forecasting the collapse of major American banks being put off till after the election. One of the banks that's in deep trouble is Citicorp, so perhaps the quote, unexpected, unquote, resignation of Citicorp's president, the second highest officer in the Citicorp hierarchy. Well, perhaps that's not quite so unexpected. Reading now from the New York Times of Saturday, September 19th of 1992, another article by Stephen Kinzer, headline, Dateline to Bonn, September 18th, headline, Germans toast Mark while they roast coal. Skipping down on the article, the image of a one-mark coin today dominated the front page of Bild, B-I-L-D, the country's best-selling newspaper. You beautiful, strong Deutschmark, the caption said. You make our life cheaper, unquote. Inside, Bild listed old and new prices for items like Italian shoes, Scotch whiskey, and Jaguar automobiles. In marks, the new prices are about 20% lower. Quote, all true, no joke, unquote, the paper assured its readers, again quoting, we Germans can choose what we want from supermarket Europe, unquote. Well, supermarket Europe, I suppose, is something of an improvement from what Hitler referred to as Forschung Europa, Fortress Europe. However, it does not necessarily bode well for the rest of the world's economies. And ultimately, if there is a collapse in this country, it figures to hurt Germany as well, in as much as the world economy is deeply it is a world economy, and our economy is inextricably linked with that of Germany and those of the other major industrial nations. Speaking of the very strong Deutsche Mark and Europe, supermarket Europe, as Bill referred to it, reading now from the L.A. Times of Tuesday, September 22nd of 1992, another article by Tamara Jones of the L.A. Times. This is a profile of the president of the Bundesbank, Helmut Schlesinger. Profile, global economic spotlight falls on Dr. D-Mark, on, quote, Mr. D-Mark. Subheaded, Germany's starchy central bank president is suddenly being portrayed as an ogre in the international media. Skipping to the inside, and bear in mind the weakness of the American financial system as you listen to the following. 5 years later, James A. Baker III, then U.S. Treasury Secretary, fingered Schlesinger in the disastrous 1987 Wall Street crash. Quote, it's a little clique headed by Helmut Schlesinger, unquote. Baker fumed at the time. They are rigid monetarists bent on zero inflation no matter what, unquote. It was the conservative Schlesinger, asserted Baker, who engineered four Bundesbank interest rate hikes, including one a week before Black Monday, after other high-ranking German officials had promised there would be no such increases in an effort to keep the U.S. dollar from dipping too low. Skipping down, like many prominent Germans, Schlesinger served with Nazi forces in a Wehrmacht mountain unit during World War II. He then studied economics at the University of Munich, finishing with a doctoral thesis on, quote, economic efficiency control in the civil service, unquote. Well, in an earlier installment of RFA 37, we took a look at the restoration of the entire Third Reich civil service at the end of World War II. And one question I have, and it may be nothing to this, and I want to underscore this, I wonder whether perhaps that Wehrmacht mountain unit was perhaps the Prinz-Eugen division, a Waffen-SS mountain division deeply involved in some of the atrocities that were committed against the Yugoslavian partisans during World War II. By the way, a good account of the depredations of the Prinz-Eugen division that can be found in a book called Wartime by Milovan Gilas, D-G-I-L-A-S, one of the leaders of the Yugoslavian partisans during World War II. He then became a prominent Yugoslavian dissident and spent much of his post-war career in Tito's jails. Skipping down in this very same article of Helmut Schlesinger, though a Catholic Bavarian by birth, Schlesinger is frequently described as more Prussian in demeanor, the embodiment of the classic German work ethic. In 1952, he was lured to the Bank of German States, the forerunner of the Bundesbank, by his Munich mentor and the future Bundesbank president, Otmar Emminger, E-M-M-I-N-G-E-R. By the way, I want to underscore a point that I've made in previous installments of RFA 37. This should not be interpreted as being anti-German. In the book, The New Germany and the Old Nazis, T.H. Tettens makes the point that there is a, quote, what he referred to as the other Germany, that there are a great many democratically minded and politically evolved Germans. However, he was not optimistic about their ability to prevail in the long run, simply because the institutions of the Third Reich, the military, the judicial system, the civil service, and the political leadership were put back in power. But again, this should not be interpreted as being an indictment of the German people per se. And let's take a look also at some of the headlines coming out of some of the stories coming out of Eastern Europe at this time, because the many of the activities that are going on in Eastern Europe and many of the institutions which have returned to power in Eastern Europe are the same institutions and the same activities that prevailed during the fascist period. Reading from the New York Times of Monday, October 5th of 1992, an op-ed column by George Soros, S-O-R-O-S, an Hungarian philanthropist. This is an open letter that he wrote to Prime Minister Josef Antall, A-N-T-A-L-L, skipping down. Actually, the op-ed column reads in part, "In recent months, a series of articles published in several Hungarian newspapers attacked me as well as the foundation I established in Hungary. Most of these articles appeared in a newspaper edited by the vice president of the ruling party, Hungarian Democratic Forum, or HDF. The authors are not private individuals. They are members of parliament, and one of them is a vice president of the party. If these attacks were limited to personal insults and slander, I would not feel compelled to turn to you. My intentions and my actions have always been open to scrutiny. It is not the government's role to defend me. However, what we are dealing with here is more than mere insult. Leading members of your party have accused me of nothing less than taking part in an international anti-Hungarian conspiracy whose origins can be traced to Israel and whose goal is to extinguish the Hungarian people's national spirit, making them susceptible to foreign domination. Other participants in this conspiracy are, according to them, Jews throughout the world, Hungarian Jews, capitalists, liberals, and communists, as well as, quote, cosmopolitans, unquote, and Freemasons. To prove that these astonishing allegations were actually made, please allow me to cite from some of them, skipping down. Quote, termites are devouring our nation. Reflections on the Soros regime, the Soros empire, unquote, is the title of an article by Zsula Zasek, Z-A-C-S-E-K, an HDF member of parliament, Hungarian Forum, September 3, 1992. Mr. Zasek's premise is that, quote, the bouquet of terms, communism, liberalism, cosmopolitan, and anti-Semitism is inescapable, unquote. He claims, moreover, that, quote, in Hungary, the role played jointly by communists and Jews in their pursuit of power is unquestionable. Well, the Hungarian Democratic Forum, formerly the New Democratic Forum, has, as we looked at in RFA 36, and as we have reprised in RFA 37, served as a repository for many of the residual Arrow Cross elements, the Arrow Cross being the fascist organization of Hungary during World War II that allied with Adolf Hitler. An alumnus, of that organization, Laszlo Pastor, founded the Republican Heritage Groups Council. He also was the director of the Free Congress Foundation's Liberation Support Alliance and was very active with the New Democratic Forum, now the Hungarian Democratic Forum. So it should not perhaps be too surprising to see things like this coming out of that particular body. Turning to the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, October 7th of 1992, an article entitled Freedom Loses Luster for Hungarian Family. This is an article by Frank Viviano, V-I-V-I-A-N-O, of the Chronicle staff. It's datelined Budapest, and apparently those kinds of statements about cosmopolitans and the worldwide Jewish conspiracy, reminiscent of what Hitler spoke of, those statements are finding a sympathetic audience in Hungary. Skipping down on the story, but it is the other consequences of change that really concern Ava. Those Hungarians who haven't been successful at keeping up are beginning to look for scapegoats, someone to blame for the fact that Hungary after freedom appears to be a poorer, more uncertain place than Hungary was under goulash communism. Many blame Jews, even though most of Hungary's Jews were slaughtered by the Nazis in World War II. The charge comes not from a skinhead fringe, as in Germany, but from a leading figure in the Magyar Democratic Forum party president and publisher, István Szurka, C-S-U-R-K-A. In August, Circa wrote an article in his newspaper, Magyar Forum, that alluded to, quote, the genetic roots, unquote, of Hungary's social problems. Jewish international bankers, he claimed, were plotting to control the Hungarian economy in league with traitorous Hungarian politicians. Jewish international bankers, he claimed, were plotting to control the Hungarian economy in league with traitorous Hungarian politicians controlled by, quote, liaisons in Paris, New York, and Tel Aviv, unquote. Late last month, 50,000 people marched in Budapest to protest growing anti-Semitism. The protests were not enough to reassure Ava. Quote, we don't know if my husband's ancestors were actually Jewish, only that Stenzinger, S-T-E-N-C-Z-I-N-G-E-R, isn't a typically Hungarian name, unquote, she said. Again quoting, but more and more people ask us about it. Are you Jews? They say, unquote. I have noted in previous installments of RFA 37 how the map of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union has been redrawn along precisely the lines that Alfred Rosenberg's Ostministerium intended it to be redrawn. And again, in the triumph of rollback or liberation theory, we've not only seen that map redrawn along the lines that Rosenberg had advocated, we have also seen the rise of such organizations as Sejudis in Lithuania. We've seen the Ruk organization, which hails back to Stefan Bandera, coming to the fore in the Ukraine. In Russia, Boris Yeltsin's very close to the Free Congress Foundation. We've seen the Arrow Cross returning in Hungary. We've seen the World Slovak Congress, a repository for the Third Reich collaborationist Linka Party, gaining new sway in the now independent state of Slovakia. The Ustasha resurgent in Croatia under Franjo Tudjman. We've seen the Iron Guard in Romania staging a comeback of sorts. And it would not surprise me that if, in fact, the economic situation in that part of the world does not improve, it would not surprise me to see most, if not all, of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union turning fascist. And indeed, there are indications that parts of that world are moving in that direction, and not just Hungary. Reading from the Los Angeles Times of Tuesday, September 8th of 1992. This is an article by Elizabeth Shogren, S-O-G-R-E-N, of the L.A. Times, Dateline, St. Petersburg, Russia, headlined, new breed of fascist rises in Russia. Subheaded politics. Right-wing and ultra-nationalist. These ideologues are fanning hatreds to win support. It reads in part as follows. During a 900-day siege that cost almost 700,000 lives here, the Nazis failed to fight their way into the city's center. But five decades later, homegrown fascists now claim St. Petersburg as the, quote, spiritual center, unquote, of their nationwide movement. The fascist leader is a police detective whose heroes are Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Their chief ideologist is a 23-year-old who teaches university Polish and writes ultranationalist tracts in her spare time. One of their sponsors is a new Russian entrepreneur who donates a chunk of his earnings to train young supremacists to fight. Note Arnold Schwarzenegger as one of his idols. Schwarzenegger himself is the son of a Nazi, and he's an individual who is talking about running as governor of California, running for governor of California. You've heard of the Luftwaffe. Get ready for the Luftwaffe. Continuing. At first glance, they seem like a motley bunch to promote fascism in a country weary of ideology after seven decades of communism. But this trio, plus about 400 others in the People's Socialist Party, say the time will soon be ripe to start rebuilding their country in the style of Hitler's Germany, Benito Mussolini's Italy, and Francisco Franco's Spain. Quote, no one believed that the Führer would come to power either, or Franco or Mussolini, but the people backed them, unquote, said Viktor Krasavin, K-R-A-S-A-V-I-N, an entrepreneur and party sponsor. Again quoting, when the very foundations of a nation are being threatened, the people believe that their natural leaders. Our people are not quite ready for it yet, but the Democrats will do everything that is necessary to prepare people for it. unquote. And again, if there is a worldwide financial collapse, and I'm afraid that the collapse of major financial banks in the United States could trigger such a thing, I'm not a financial expert, but that's one possibility that I think we have to be prepared for. It'll be interesting to see what the effects of that are on nations all over the world. It would not surprise me to see many nations, including this one, the U.S., driven into the arms of fascism. Recall that it was the social dislocation that was produced by the runaway German inflation of the early 20s, plus the Great Depression, which was even more severe in Germany than in the United States, that drove the German people into the arms of Hitler. If the capital from the West that the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe have foreseen as coming does not in fact come, it would not surprise me, as I've said, to see that part of the world, or much of it, turn fascist. Skipping down on this story, the fascists are trying to turn to fan public hatred by publicizing cases of Russians being killed or raped by Azerbaijanis, Armenians, Georgians, or others from the Caucasus. Recall that there are forces in this country attempting to manipulate images of black Americans in a similar fashion. Continuing, I should say. Quote, "We need to create the image of an enemy," unquote, said Belayev, who has been on the police force for 12 years and is a St. Petersburg city council member. Quote, "How can we go to battle without an enemy?" Unquote. A poll by the Sociology of Parliamentarianism Institute showed that almost 80% of Muscovites agree that the fewer people from the Caucasus in Russia, the better. That indicates that the people's socialists may not have far to go to reach their first goal. Last sentence again. A poll by the Sociology of Parliamentarianism Institute showed that almost 80% of Muscovites agree that the fewer people from the Caucasus in Russia, the better. That indicates that the people's socialists may not have far to go to reach their first goal. Then they will move to, quote, unseen enemies, unquote, like Jews and later Christians, because their turn-the-other-cheek ethic prevents Russians from buying into the might-makes-right philosophy that the people's socialists espouse, added Belayev, a short, stocky man with frightened eyes. He said he hopes the energy created by this hatred will help bring his party to power, adding, quote, "Nationalism is our weapon. Only brutal nationalism can lead Russia." And skipping down and describing the reactions of many non-fascist Russian citizens to this, quote, "There are lots of people looking for an enemy to blame for their problems, so the fascist ideology is prospering," unquote, said Igor Ulyanov, U-L-Y-A-N-O-V, 29, a security guard and Yeltsin supporter. Again quoting, "I think Russia must be the most racist country in the world," unquote. "There is no ideological or moral frame of reference anymore," he said, "because everyone was taught to judge everything based on the principles of communism, which has now been discredited." Quote, "I personally am afraid," unquote, added Ulyanov, a tall, muscular man. Again quoting, "Although I've lived here with my family for 8 years, I'm Ukrainian. Any time they can say, 'You're not one of us, get out of here,'" unquote. But Valentina Greshikina, G-R-E-C-H-I-S-K-I-N-A, 82, a German teacher who was there through the whole 900-day blockade of Leningrad, as St. Petersburg was formerly known, said she does not want to believe that fascism could gain support in her city. Quote, "Leningrad suffered so much under fascism," she said, again quoting, "I cannot believe that after this, fascism could find a base here." Again quoting, "I'm a Russian, and I believe we need to be patriots of our nation," unquote, she added, and again quoting, "but I believe that you must look at a person as an individual, not judge him because of his nationality," unquote. But she also noted that recently she has sensed that her students have a new attitude about Hitler. Quote, "Many of my students are reading Mein Kampf, and they say they like his approach," unquote. Last two sentences again. But she also noted that recently she has sensed that her students have a new attitude about Hitler. Again quoting, "Many of my students are reading Mein Kampf, and they say they like his approach." Well, I've described and detailed at great length, of course, in Radio Free America 37, begun all the way back on July 26th of 1992, how the rollback or liberation theory triumphed in the United States. That was originally a Third Reich political and psychological warfare tactic. It evolved into a major American political and psychological warfare tactic as a result of the importation of the Galen Organization, and then as a result of the Crusade for Freedom. It became a dominant element in American politics. It achieved its triumph. It became the triumphant element through the assassination of John Kennedy, and it reached its fulfillment under the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. And now it would appear that it has borne the fruit, or is bearing the fruit, in the former Soviet Union, in its former Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, that Alfred Rosenberg, Galen, Hitler et al. Were hoping that it would bear. And what we are seeing, in my opinion, and that's why I have gone into Radio Free America 37 at the great length that I have gone into it, is basically the worldwide triumph of fascism. Fascism, as I have indicated so often, is not something alien to the United States. It is, in my opinion, in the process of triumphing in the United States, and it apparently is triumphing elsewhere as well. And the effects for the human race, I don't think, could possibly be exaggerated. I'm afraid that if the world citizenry and those of us here in the United States who oppose this kind of thing are not able to be successful, then what is going to befall the world is what Winston Churchill, in a famous wartime address, warned would happen if Hitler won. And Winston Churchill said that if the Nazis won, quote, the world would be plunged into an abyss made more sinister by the knights of perverted science. And Bertolt Brecht, the famous playwright, also had a phrase that I think we should bear a few lines that I think we should bear in mind. In speaking of Adolf Hitler, Brecht wrote, "Do not rejoice in his defeat, you men. Though the world rose up and beat the bastard, the bitch that bore him is in heat again." Well, I'm afraid she's not in heat. I'm afraid she's bearing a litter, and a rather large litter it is. Unfortunately, people have not read the history of fascism. They have not studied the record. In particular, those of us in the United States have not studied the record of fascism. Well, we didn't read the book. Now we're going to see the movie, and this one is a 3D picture, folks, and it does not have a happy ending. And as I've indicated earlier in the broadcast, in reality, all of the other archive programs that I have done, and the programs I'm going to be doing, archival and otherwise, serve to illustrate the effects on American society, as well as the rest of the world, of the processes that I have been delineating in Radio Free America 37. So in a sense, the conclusion that I am bringing RFA 37 to on October 18th, 1992, is a premature conclusion. At some point I have to wind this archive show up, but in reality this archive show is an ongoing reality, and it's something we are going to have to bear in mind. It's something we're going to have to deal with, because again, as I have done my best to illustrate, the United States lost the Second World War. Not a military defeat, not a defeat on the battlefield, but a political defeat and a consequent economic defeat. And it is vitally important that we bear in mind the information that I've delineated, because this is a truth that people will not want to listen to. And yet, if we look around us, the manifestations of the triumph of the processes that I've been delineating are evident all around us. And if we don't get busy, they will remain as enduring institutions. And we will find ourselves living in a world ruled by the minions of Hitler, with 21st century technology, and that is not a pleasant concept. And that, dear listeners, the programs I've been putting together since July 26th, that is how the United States lost the Second World War.
That's Buck Rogers stuff.
You can't get away with that in this day and age.
You don't have to take my word for it. Just read your own newspapers. Right-hand column, page 3, New York Times of May 26th. An Associated Press dispatch from London, dated May 31st. The three-column story on page 5 in the New York Post on February 5th. Page 51 on Life magazine for May 8th. Our plans are not...
What I'm going to do next, before a musical break, is to review something that I review periodically on this broadcast by way of presenting people with a barometer against which, or that they can use to measure this country's descent into fascism. I have read periodically over the years from a book called They Thought They Were Free, subtitled The Germans, 1933 to 1945. That was authored by Milton Mayer, published in softcover by the University of Chicago Press,
and again copyrighted 1955. There is a chapter called But Then It Was Too Late, and this is a description by a German university professor of what it was like, subjectively, to live under the rise of Hitler. Reading from They Thought They Were Free, quote, "What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. And their sense of identification with Hitler, their trust in him, made it easier to widen this gap and reassured those who would otherwise have worried about it." Quote, "This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter." Quote, "You will understand me when I say that my middle high German was my life. It was all I cared about. I was a scholar, a specialist. Then suddenly I was plunged into all the new activity, as the university was drawn into the new situation. Meetings, conferences, interviews, ceremonies, and above all papers to be filled out, reports, bibliographies, lists, questionnaires. And on top of that were the demands in the community, the things in which one was, quote, expected to participate that had not been there or had not been important before. It was all rigmarole, of course, but it consumed all one's energies, coming on top of the work one really wanted to do. You can see how easy it was then not to think about fundamental things. One had no time," unquote. "Those," unquote, I said, "are the words of my friend the baker. One had no time to think. There was so much going on," unquote. "Your friend the baker was right," said my colleague. "The dictatorship and the whole process of it coming into being was above all diverting. It provided an excuse not to think for people who did not want to think anyway. I do not speak of your little men, your baker, and so on. I speak of my colleagues and myself, learned men, mind you. Most of us did not want to think about fundamental things and never had. There was no need to. Nazism gave us some dreadful, fundamental things to think about. We were decent people and kept us so busy with continuous changes and, quote, crises, unquote, and so fascinated, yes, fascinated by the machinations of the national enemies, quote, unquote, without and within, that we had no time to think about those dreadful things that were growing little by little all around us. Unconsciously, I suppose, we were grateful. Who wants to think? To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness acuity than most of us ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained or on occasion, quote, regretted, unquote, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these, quote, little measures, unquote, that, quote, no patriotic German, unquote, could resent, must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, it is over his head. Quote, how is this to be avoided among ordinary men, even highly educated ordinary men? Frankly, I do not know. I do not see even now. Many, many times since it all happened, I have pondered that pair of great maxims, Principis obsta et finem respice, resist the beginnings and consider the end. But one must foresee the end in order to resist or even see the beginnings. One must foresee the end clearly. And certainly, how is this to be done by ordinary men or even by extraordinary men? Things might have changed here before they went as far as they did. They didn't, but they might have. And everyone counts on that might. Your little men, your Nazi friends, were not against National Socialism in principle. Men like me who were are the greater offenders, not because we knew better. That would be too much to say, but because we sensed better. Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke too modestly of himself and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist, and so he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier, but still he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the schools, the press, the Jews, and so on, and he was always uneasier, but still he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something, but then it was too late, unquote. Yes, I said. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next, and the next. You wait for one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to, quote, go out of your way to make trouble, unquote. Why not? Well, you are not in the habit of doing it. And it is not just fear of standing alone, that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, quote, everyone, unquote, is happy. One hears no protest and certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there would be slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. In Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps, there is not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, it's not so bad, unquote, or you're seeing things, unquote, or you're an alarmist, unquote. And you are an alarmist. You are saying that this must lead to this, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. You are left with your close friends, who are naturally people who have always thought as you have. But your friends are fewer now. Some have drifted off somewhere or submerged themselves in their work. You no longer see as many as you did at meetings or gatherings. Informal groups become smaller, attendance drops off in little organizations, and the organizations themselves wither. Now, in small gatherings of your oldest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourself, that you are isolated from the reality of things. This weakens your confidence still further, and serves as a further deterrent to what? It is clear all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it, and then you are obviously a troublemaker. So you wait, and you wait. But the one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds or thousands will join with you never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been sufficiently shocked. If, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than Step B, and if you did not make a stand at Step B, why should you at Step C? And so on to Step D. And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, Jew swine, collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring, the houses, the jobs, the shops, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now, You live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. The system itself could not have intended this in the beginning, but in order to sustain itself, it was compelled to go all the way. You have gone almost all the way yourself. Life is a continuing process, a flow, not a succession of acts and events at all. It has flowed to a new level, carrying you with it without any effort on your part. On this new level you live, you have been living more comfortably every day with new morals, new principles. You have accepted things you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things that your father, even in Germany, could not have imagined. Quote, suddenly it all comes down, all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or more accurately, what you haven't done. For that was all that was required of most of us, that we do nothing. You remember those early meetings of your department in the university when if one had stood, others would have stood perhaps, but no one stood. A small matter, a matter of hiring this man or that, and you hired this one rather than that. You remember everything now and your heart breaks. Too late. You are compromised beyond repair. What then? You must then shoot yourself, a few did, or, quote, adjust, unquote, your principles. Many tried, and some, I suppose, succeeded. Not I, however. Or learn to live the rest of your life with your shame. This last is the nearest there is under the circumstances to heroism. Shame. Many Germans became this poor kind of hero, many more, I think, than the world knows or cares to know. I said nothing. I thought of nothing to say. Again quoting the professor, I can tell you, my colleague went on, of a man in Leipzig, a judge. He was not a Nazi, except nominally, but he certainly wasn't an anti-Nazi. He was just a judge. In 42 or 43, early 43, I think it was, a Jew was tried before him in a case involving, but only incidentally, relations with an, quote, Aryan, unquote, woman. This was, quote, race injury, unquote, something the party was especially anxious to punish. In the case at bar, however, the judge had the power to convict the man of a non-racial offense and send him to an ordinary prison for a very long term, thus saving him from party, quote, processing, unquote, which would have meant concentration camp or more probably deportation and death. But the man was innocent of the non-racial charge in the judge's opinion, and so, as an honorable judge, he acquitted him. Of course, the party seized the Jew as soon as he left the courtroom, unquote. And the judge? I asked. Again quoting. Yes, the judge. He could not get the case off his conscience, a case, mind you, in which he had acquitted an innocent man. He thought he should have convicted him and saved him from the party, but how could he have convicted an innocent man? The thing preyed on him more and more, and he had to talk about it, first to his family, then to his friends, then to acquaintances. That's how I heard about it. After the 44 Putsch, they arrested him. After that, I don't know. Unquote. I said nothing. Again quoting, once the war began, my colleague continued, resistance, protest, criticism, complaint, all carried with them a multiplied likelihood of the greatest punishment. Mere lack of enthusiasm or failure to show it in public was, quote, defeatism, unquote. You assumed that there were lists of those who would be, quote, dealt with, unquote, later after the victory. Goebbels was very clever here, too. He continually promised a, quote, victory orgy, unquote, to, quote, take care of, unquote, those who thought that their treasonable attitude had escaped notice. And he meant it. That was not just propaganda. And that was enough to put an end to all uncertainty. Once the war began, the government could do anything, quote, necessary, unquote, to win it. So it was with the final solution of the Jewish problem, which the Nazis always talked about but never dared undertake, not even the Nazis, until war and its, quote, necessities, unquote, gave them the knowledge that they could get away with it. The people abroad, who thought that war against Hitler would help the Jews, were wrong. And the people in Germany, who once the war had begun, still thought of complaining, protesting, resisting, were betting on Germany's losing the war. It was a long bet. not many made it, unquote. And again, I think people would do well to think about what's going on in this country today and think about where they fit in this particular situation. An awful lot of people, I suspect, are thinking very much along these lines. Again, quoting, "The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed." Still, cheer for the Niners. You can still go to your wine tastings. You can still go to the art festival downtown. You can sit back and turn on the TV and watch some jive program or turn on the stereo. You can still go for a walk in the redwood forests, at least for the time being. They may be cut down pretty soon. But the spirit has changed, and we are now living in a very, very different country.
That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast. This is Dave Emery thanking all the listeners for their contributions and encouraging them to tune in again to the next broadcast. Until then, take care.